The aim of this short talk is to introduce the book of James by providing some background information and general guidance that will help you to read it more profitably. Let's start with James himself. Who exactly was he? Well, there are several people called James in the New Testament. Two of the 12 disciples have that name, the better known being the brother of John. The father of yet another disciple, Judas, not Iscariot, was also called James. And then there is a James the Younger, whose mother, Mary, was at the crucifixion of Jesus. That's Mark 15, verse 40. But our James is none of these. Rather, he was one of the brothers, really half-brothers, of Jesus. And four of these are mentioned by name in Matthew chapter 13, verse 55. You might think this family connection gave James a rather privileged position, or at least an advantage. Maybe so. But in fact, it must have created an unusual tension. Just imagine one of your brothers at the age of 30 suddenly taking up a teaching ministry based upon him actually being the Messiah. There are two occasions we know about when this tension surfaced. In one case, when Jesus was teaching the crowds, James, together with his mother and other brothers, arrived at the house where they were all gathered, only to hear Jesus refer to the disciples seated around him as his brothers. For Jesus, doing God's will was what made someone part of his real family. That's Mark chapter 3, verses 31 to 35. Perhaps it's no wonder, therefore, that when the time arrived for the family to make the trip to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles, that Jesus' brothers taunted him by saying that this was his big moment to show himself as the Messiah. Go and perform your miracles in the big city where everyone can see who you are. And what we learn from this is that at this point, none of Jesus' brothers, including James, believed in him. You can see John chapter 7, verses 1 to 5 for this. So what eventually made the difference? How did James become a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, as he describes himself in the opening of his letter? Quite simply, because of the resurrection. This is what turned him into a believer. We learn in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 7 that Jesus appeared to James as part of his many post-resurrection appearances. So although James may not have been one of the original 12 disciples, it seems he quickly caught up. Perhaps his experience of growing up with Jesus and the particular manner of his later conversion gave him a unique role within the early church, and made what he taught especially meaningful. Certainly we can trust what he says in his letter, as so much of it reflects what Jesus taught. Notice, by the way, that James doesn't open his letter by stating, Jesus was my brother. Rather, as we've just said, by declaring himself as a servant of Jesus, whom he now reveres as the Lord Jesus Christ. Incidentally, another brother of Jesus, the one called Judas, who preferred to be known as Jude, perhaps for obvious reasons, also described himself as a servant, not brother, of Jesus Christ in the opening of his letter. That's Jude verse 1. But he did also add that he was a brother of James, perhaps recognising James as the more senior of the family brothers of Jesus. Why would Jude include this extra reference to James? Well, perhaps it's because James held the honoured position of being the leader, or presiding elder, of the church in Jerusalem. And in particular, he chaired the important council held there, as recorded in Acts chapter 15. History records that James didn't travel as a missionary or evangelist. Rather, he stayed in Jerusalem for 30 years, until his death in AD 62. So presumably, he wrote his letter from there, perhaps based upon what was taught in his own church at Jerusalem. James received a worthy accolade by becoming known as James the Just, presumably because he made good decisions as leader of the Jerusalem church. He's also described in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 9 as one of the pillars of the church in general. And he gained the extra nickname of Camel Knees, because they become so hardened by spending many hours on his knees in prayer. Eventually, in AD 62, he died a martyr's death. the Jewish rulers in Jerusalem took advantage of a 2-month vacancy in the Roman governorship. In that period between Festus and Albinus, the Jews attacked Christians in general, and James was a particular target. They took him to the pinnacle of the temple and told him to denounce Christ or be thrown off. He was thrown off. But he didn't kill him, so they stoned his broken body until he breathed his last. So that's James. What about his book? Should we call it a letter? It opens like one with a brief greeting, but it doesn't end like one with a final benediction or grace in the way that the other New Testament letters tend to do. So it's regarded as a general or cyclical letter, not sent to a specific place or individual, but rather one that was intended to be taken around many places or Christian communities. In this case, churches that contained Jewish believers who lived outside the land of Israel. The phrase 12 tribes is not to be taken as a literal description, they're not really tribes, or a precise numerical statement, it was not sent to 12 different locations. Rather, it is a way of describing the recipients as Jewish, descended from the original tribes of Israel, but now dispersed among the nations, perhaps mainly around the Mediterranean area. Although James probably never met them, it is noticeable how frequently throughout the letter he addresses his readers, or perhaps we should say his audience, as brothers, about a dozen times in total. It's interesting to speculate whether this emphasis is based upon the incident we mentioned above, in which James heard Jesus say that whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother. That was Mark 3, verse 35. Perhaps that was a shock to James at the time, but later he understood what Jesus was really saying. Just as Jesus felt he had a bigger family than his natural one because of who his father really was, so now James realises this too. And so should we. Other true Christians are our family now, and we should treat them as brothers and sisters. That's clearly something to think about as we go through this letter. The style of this letter is interesting and rather unusual. It reads more like a spoken address. You are being preached at rather than written to, which is why I referred a moment ago to his readers as his audience. The letter contains a lot of devices commonly used by speakers. You feel him addressing you personally with phrases such as "not many of you" or "is any one of you" or even "if one of you should wander from the truth, yes, that could be you." At times he exhorts us to listen. "Now listen, you who say," or "now listen, you rich people, are you going to get this message? It's aimed at you." And James isn't afraid to use harsh language where necessary. James invents imaginary situations and conversations to raise the level of interest and get us involved. He also asks rhetorical questions, ones where the answer's obvious but which are intended to make us think further. "Don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred towards God?" "Well, yes, I do. So now will this knowledge make any difference to what you do?" James often introduces new ideas and topics via a direct question. "What causes fights and quarrels among you?" he asks at the opening of chapter 4. He's also happy to use what appears to be paradoxical statements. Trials are to be considered as pure joy. That's chapter 1, verse 2. And his letter is also full of imperatives or commands to do this or not do that. Someone has counted about 60 of these. James is also fond of using pictures and figures from everyday life. Ship's rudders, forest fires, bridles and horses, fig trees and spring water, among others. He also refers to 4 famous people from the past: Abraham, Rahab, Job and Elijah. So you'll need to brush up on your Old Testament if you want to follow his arguments in these places. Overall, it certainly seems as though James is delivering this teaching verbally, which is why it's good to hear the whole letter read out loud. Someone else might have written it down for him later, but James wanted us to hear what he has to say. It may be that the letter is based upon teaching he regularly gave at Jerusalem, and what he wanted others elsewhere to know. In which case, this is not just what he taught, but also how he taught. And we are privileged to be listening in. Just imagine you are attending one of his meetings. Well, at least you know you will be treated without favouritism. That's the opening of chapter 2. It's often said that this letter is a jumbled collection of sayings, somewhat illogically constructed. James jumps about from topic to topic, starting a subject only to leave it and come back to it later. There are some longer passages that develop a theme, but he certainly does wander around at times. So the letter is often compared to the Old Testament book of Proverbs, with its emphasis on practical wisdom as well as its fairly random structure. And we also find within the letter of James much that is reminiscent of Jesus' teaching in the so-called Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapters 5-7. Some say there are over 20 such references, some being obvious, perhaps others a little less so. There's a good exercise for the dedicated student among us. Perhaps it's not surprising that James included a lot of what his brother taught. Jesus didn't leave anything in writing, so maybe James thought he should make up for this. We might wonder also if James ever heard Jesus teaching. Might he have been present on occasions such as the Sermon on the Mount? Well, it's difficult to say, given that he was not a disciple at the time. But he would certainly have picked all this up later from the other apostles. Or maybe he also had access to many of the sayings of Jesus when they were eventually written down, in a document such as the Didache, for example, which was commonly used in the early church to disciple new believers. James was Jewish, and it's not surprising that his style and technique reflects this. Rabbis often mused aloud rather than giving a prepared address. This commonly used method, called sharaz, can be thought of as holding up pearls of wisdom and stringing them together, perhaps in what seems a rather haphazard way. But this is deliberately so, as it engages the listener better than a highly polished piece of oratory. Overall, James employed a style which suited his purpose, namely to invite action, not analysis. Here is no-nonsense, down-to-earth, practical Christianity for daily life. There are no great doctrinal statements or pieces of theology. References to Jesus are minimal, and there's no mention of his death or resurrection. Rather, this is what you do once you are a believer in these things. And this is the main problem with this letter. It's easy to understand, but challenging to put into practice. One person who had problems with this letter was Martin Luther. He wasn't happy with it at all. In fact, it's said he was disgusted with it. He called it an epistle of straw. It's not clear whether this is because he found nothing of nourishment in it or because it seemed to be merely a series of disconnected strands. But it certainly didn't suit his legally trained analytical mind, which much preferred the sort of arguments you could find in Paul's letters with its theological debates about justification, righteousness, salvation and the like. He rather wished the letter of James wasn't in the New Testament at all. In fact, he disliked it so much that when he translated the New Testament into German, he put James into an appendix. We don't have that option. We can't relegate it to an appendix. We have to take it seriously. We need to listen to James, the unbelieving brother who became the leader of a major community of Christian disciples. But above all, we need to live in the way that James says, to make sure that the world's morals, motives and methods remain external to all that we do. This is an immense ongoing challenge. We face the same pressures as the believers did in James's day. So this letter is still up to date and of everlasting value.